Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And boy, oh boy, what a week in InfoSec, am I right? We're going to recap all of the week's security news with Adam Boileau in a minute. But we'll be putting a pretty heavy emphasis on the now hotly disputed Bloomberg Big Hack story. This is the piece that claims China, or agents of the Chinese government, have been implanting hardware backdoors onto Supermicro motherboards destined for sensitive networks in the United States. That report has been denied by, as far as I can tell, every single stakeholder. And Risky Business actually ran a podcast on this yesterday that has gone rather berserk. We interviewed Joe Fitzpatrick, one of the only technical experts named and quoted in the piece, and he told us that he felt very uncomfortable reading it. He says he told the journalists who wrote it prior to publication that it didn't make any sense, and he expressed concern to me that it appeared that every hypothetical he described to Bloomberg popped up in the piece as something China is alleged to have done. Now, that could be an amazing coincidence, or the journalist might have had very confirmation-happy sources, but it doesn't look good. Bloomberg is standing by the story, but we're going to take a bit of a deep dive on some more of that in just a moment. This week's show is brought to you by Senatas. Senatas is best known for making Layer 2 encryption technology like 100 gigabit per second full line rate encryptors. Senatas CEO Andrew Wilson is this week's sponsor guest, and we're sticking with the theme of supply chain risk in this week's sponsor interview. He'll be telling us what steps his company takes to reduce supply chain risk, and then he takes a swipe at Australia's proposed access and assistance bill. This is the controversial so-called anti-encryption bill. He's worried that it could make some customers based overseas suspicious of Australian equipment and actually damage Australia's technology exports. That's a great interview, and it's coming up later on. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, we're going to kick off this week's news segment by having a chat about Bloomberg's giant flaming pile of shit. When this story first landed, what did you make of it? Because I'm really curious what you thought of it.
Well, I mean, I was surprised and I was shocked. And in a way, I wanted to believe it. I read it and I thought, this is a big deal. This is going to, I've got Supermicro boxes of my own, and I've had issues with the lights out management stuff, and I believed it. Like, I read it on face value. I thought, the hardware details seem a little bit, the chip looks really small, and I'd really like to see an actual teardown. And I went, Googling and looking to see if anyone had actually got some hardware and didn't find anything. And, I kind of left it at that. I thought through the mechanisms by which how it could work. I think I made some musings on Twitter about it, even which are, I'm not a hardware guy, but we're basically on the track of the story. And then things just kind of, started to unravel.
They sure did. I mean, I got swept up in the whole thing because I had a source who's done a teardown on a Supermicro board. And they did find problems, right? Like, they're not the most secure, like the secure elements of those boards are not exactly fantastic. And as we're going to talk about in a minute, there have been legitimate questions raised about the firmware of those boards and maybe some dodgy stuff happening with the supply chain there. Like, really legitimate questions. But as far as it, as far as this whole thing relates to extra components being soldered onto motherboards, it appears that this whole thing is completely bunk.
Yeah, that's a really kind of strange place to be because, obviously, supply chain attacks are a very real thing. There is a bunch of concern about it, about hardware sourced in China, about software, about the supply chains, for all these sorts of things. And to have a story come out this big and then for it to turn out to be bogus, which is kind of where it's heading, it just helps no one. And it's such a, this is just not a great day for, for InfoSec or for journalism.
Now, look, we did, as I say, I had a source who was actually at one point saying, we found similar stuff on our teardown. They later got in touch with me and said, well, actually, no, and I didn't mean to confirm that part when I'd specifically asked them to confirm that part, right? So there was a combination of, I guess, miscommunication followed by, I don't know, this person getting excited. So I had to retract that within about, I think it was within about 18 hours. I had to retract that claim, but then, you know, done a little bit more digging, had a chat with Joe Fitzpatrick, who is one of the sources on this story. I mean, that podcast, I published it yesterday. It has made waves. It is being quoted by a number of media outlets. I believe Apple's press team have even transcribed it and are passing it around to media outlets, right, as a way for them to sort of help to discredit this Bloomberg story. Bloomberg has been directly in touch with me. Their statement reads, and I'll quote from it, "As is typical journalistic practice, we reached out to many people who are subject matter experts to help us understand and describe technical aspects of the attack. The specific ways the implant worked were described, confirmed, and elaborated on by our primary sources who have direct knowledge of the compromised Supermicro hardware. Joe Fitzpatrick was not one of these 17 individual primary sources that included company insiders and government officials, and his direct quote in the story describes a hypothetical example of how a hardware attack might play out, as the story makes clear. Our reporters and editors thoroughly vet every story before publication, and this was no exception." There's only one problem with that, and that's that Bloomberg has a history of publishing bogus stories in InfoSec. And I mean, that is a big call. That's a very big call for a journalist to say about another outlet that they're publishing bogus material. I just want to draw people's attention to two other stories that these journalists, either under solo bylines or under the same, you know, double barrel byline, have written up. Now, both of these stories that I'm going to talk about were published in 2014. One of them says that a 2008 pipeline explosion in Turkey was actually the work of Russian hackers. Now, they come up with some very specific bits of evidence for this thing. Now, I should point out too, Robert Lee, who at the time of the alleged incident worked in ICS security for the National Security Agency, was approached by these journalists and asked about this story. He said it didn't really make sense, and he was surprised they had intelligence sources in the US who were feeding him this information, given that he was working in the relevant part of the US intelligence community when the alleged incident occurred. Now, one of the specific things they've got here is they say that there were 60 hours of surveillance video recorded, raised by the hackers, but a single infrared camera not connected to the same network captured images of two men with laptop computers walking near the pipeline days before the explosion, according to one of the people who has reviewed the video. The men wore black military-style uniforms without insignias, similar to the garb worn by Special Forces troops. Now, look, everyone, I mean, ICS people, I mean, everyone I've spoken to, you know, and I do have sources on this. Everyone says this story is a hoax. Furthermore, Thomas Ridd linked through on Twitter to an article about this incident that cited a report that said there were no surveillance cameras around this pipeline at the time of the incident. It looks to me like some of the alleged facts in this thing are fabrications, right? Actual fabrications. Now, whether or not they are the sources fabricating this information and the journalists not doing a good enough job to spot those fabrications, or whether or not it's the journalists making it up themselves, we don't know, right? One of the other stories was written by Michael Riley, also a Bloomberg story in 2014. You might remember this one. This was the one that said the NSA had been using the Heartbleed bug for 2 years. That's bullshit. It is patently bullshit. No one else has been able to substantiate it. And again, it seems like a fabrication. Could it be a fabrication that came from one of their sources and they maybe had it confirmed by another bad source? Sure. Okay. But my point is, there's a track record here and it doesn't look good.
Yeah, it really doesn't when you start to line up the pieces like that. And, you know, you kind of have to ask, you know, what they expected. You know, how could a story like this that, you know, really does rely on physical pieces of hardware that are in possession of third parties, as opposed to, you know, a video recording that one, you know, some people have seen that no one's going to be able to verify. You really got to wonder, like, how they imagined this would play out if they knew it was bunk.
Well, and, maybe they didn't. Know, I don't know.
Maybe they didn't. Yeah, So it's just kind of hard to put the. Like, it doesn't make sense, and that's the thing that's left a lot of people scratching their heads. And I imagine Apple's PR people are probably doing more than scratching their heads. The same with Amazon.
Apple's written a very detailed letter to Congress, which absolutely refutes the allegations in this story. Now, look, you know, I mentioned before that Robert M. Lee had actually, refuted this pipeline story. The exact quote here, here comes from Twitter, says, they claimed anonymous US intelligence community sources as well, except I led the ICS threat discovery mission at the time at the NSA, and I had never heard of this attack being a cyber attack. The NSA doesn't see everything, but if the US intelligence community is your source, we would have. Okay, so that's one thing to keep in mind. Now, look, I want to go back now to some coverage from 2016. We've got this report in Ars Technica, which is describing a report in The Information, right? We can't actually go through that report in The Information because it's behind a paywall. But here's a quote from that report. This is a 2016 article. It says, Apple has long suspected that servers it ordered from the traditional supply chain were intercepted during shipping with additional chips and firmware added to them by unknown third parties in order to make them vulnerable to infiltration, according to a person familiar with the matter. This is the same story. It was being floated in 2016.
Yeah, and we didn't see any, you know, real information about that story in the time since. I mean, there was some suggestion at that point that there was compromised, you know, firmware, baseboard management firmware on some systems, and there was some story that those were Supermicros that Apple had bought to run in a dev environment, and that they ended up, you know, kind of booting those systems out of their network as a result of spotting them, you know, trying to find
them. Yeah, they ended their relationship with Supermicro, and this feels more plausible, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Supermicro has a history of writing rubbish firmware. I don't know, you'd have to modify it with chips to get into a position where, you know, you could compromise those, I mean, whether it's during manufacturing or, you know, supply chain, you know, actual transit interdiction.
Now, okay, so how do we go from there, which is a one report that says that there might be some hardware implants, right, to now a story where we've got descriptions of rice-sized computers on motherboards? And this is the thing that really I find very, very unsettling about this story. First of all, there's the Joe Fitz stuff that I published yesterday, where he's basically saying, look, everything that I speculated on has appeared in the story as something the Chinese are alleged to have done. Okay, that is a bit of a red flag right there. So how do we go from these vague reports to that? And then they're claiming 17 sources. Now, look, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, it's anonymous sources, so it's all garbage. There are processes at publications for dealing with anonymously sourced information. It is supposed to be treated with more suspicion, and there is supposed to be a higher degree of cross-checking and a higher degree of verification. And yet it seems like that story is full of details. Honestly, it looks like somebody, and I'm not saying it was the journalists, somebody's just pulled those details out of their ass.
It does kind of seem that way. I mean, Joe makes a number of good points about, you know, this just not being the sensible way to approach this problem if you're the Chinese, right? There's lots of ways to go around this kind of thing. The idea that you would do it for targeted attacks through hardware modification, you know, in the style described, doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, it would make sense for doing it on a very broad brush, but then there would be hardware for us to look at. And that's the, you know, the story just doesn't make a whole bunch of sense as presented. And those details, you know, no one's been able to, you know, make much sense of them. I mean, the device in question seems really small. The position on the board seems kind of, you know, a little bit weird.
Well, no one else has found one of these devices. You'd think by now people would have tootled on down to their data center, pulled a few Supermicro motherboards out and maybe turned up something else. The best Bloomberg can do is this follow-up story, Adam, where they're saying they've got a source, at least on the record this time, this guy Yossi Applebaum, who apparently found a Trojan's nick in a Supermicro box at a US telco. He's apparently got documents that he shared with Bloomberg, but Bloomberg hasn't shared them on. Now, of course, you know, okay, it's great that they got someone on the record to talk about this, but he's describing a completely different type of hardware attack. This does nothing to substantiate the first story. Zero.
Well, exactly, right? I mean, and we've seen, you know, implants in Ethernet jacks in the NSA ANT catalog that got leaked, you know, during the Snowden disclosures. So, I mean, that kind of thing is a thing we know does happen. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't have any relationship to what they're describing in this particular piece, you know, where it's, you know, firmware modification of the baseboard management controller through a tiny hardware implant as opposed to some, you know, pre-integrated unit like an Ethernet connector or something.
So look, Adam, you're not a journalist. I understand that. But I mean, do you think that Bloomberg should really investigate this internally and really have a close look at these stories, all of them?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the trajectory of the previous stories really, you know, should be concerning to readers and, of course, the, you know, Bloomberg's management, I'm sure. And yeah, I mean, this is an extraordinary claim. It requires, you know, a higher degree of proof to really convince people. And in the end, right? I mean, what do we care about in the InfoSec? We care about empirical ground truth. Like, find me some hardware. Find me an actual board that people can actually pull apart, give it to someone like Joe Fitz or whatever, pull it apart and give us the actual raw data, right?
Then silicon or it didn't happen, I think, exactly. Is basically what you're saying. Now, look, in some people have raised a defense to me of these journalists saying, well, look, maybe they had sources who were, feeding them bad information. They've claimed 17 sources. Now, determining when a source is feeding you bad information. Now, I know I failed at this recently, okay? So I recognize that, right? I'm not perfect. I'm not claiming to be. But figuring out when an anonymous source is feeding you bad information, that is part of the job, right? Now, if you have 17 well-placed sources on this, you would think that they should have flushed that out. You would think, right? Like, I just try to add this up in any way that doesn't make these guys look incompetent or worse, and I can't arrive there.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The situation doesn't make any sense, and what could possibly make sense, right? And, you're not left with anything good.
So look, Bloomberg said nothing to indicate that they're actually taking a look at this. I've sent them some questions. I've sent questions to Public Affairs at Bloomberg, and my questions are as follow. Question number one, does Bloomberg stand by every claim made in the Big Hack piece? If not, are there details in the story Bloomberg are prepared to admit may not be accurate? What are they? Question two, does Bloomberg stand by every claim made in the following pieces? And of course, I link through to the Turkey pipeline blast story, and I link through to the NSA was using Heartbleed story. Question number three, is Bloomberg investigating the sourcing and editing of any of these works? If so, what is the nature of this investigation and who will lead it? I'm amazed that there aren't stronger calls for them to actually really take a serious look at this. And I mean, bring in an external person to audit this work. We're talking about stories where very credible people have alleged fabrication. As I say, whether or not that's sources fabricating things or whether or not that's journalists fabricating things, we don't know. But it is my sincerely held belief that that's a question that deserves answering.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And it's, this is a big story. And, in a way, I'd like it to be true because supply chain security is an important thing for this industry to take seriously. And, it's an important part of international affairs these days. And I want it to be true. I don't necessarily want it to be true, but you know what I mean? Like, I want to have accurate information so that we can make good choices. And this is just bad for everyone.
It is. And I suspect there's probably something there too. I suspect there's probably something around the firmware component. I mean, that one, if you're going to mess with the supply chain, it's my feeling that that's where you do it, right?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, and certainly doesn't require hardware modification to do so. Although, I guess there's some examples of people doing hardware stuff, but Supermicro's history on the subject, I mean, you don't even need to introduce your own bugs, right? There's enough there already.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's exactly right. All right, look, we're gonna move on because there's a lot of other news to cover this week. And look, right off the bat, we've got this amazing event here where the United Kingdom has basically come out and publicly attributed a whole bunch of activity to APT-28 or Fancy Bear.
Yeah, we've seen this kind of story arc come out with releases from the UK NCSC, from the Department of Justice in the US. We've seen some of the Dutch authorities really come out and start naming and shaming the bunch of specific campaigns carried out by by the Russian GRU as Fancy Bear. And yeah, I mean, seeing this really kind of lit up in a press release from the NCSC, I guess, kind of illustrates the change in the detente between in the way that this kind of
intelligence, it's a new way of conducting top secret intelligence, isn't it, just get your findings and make them public.
Yeah, exactly right. And seeing the NCSC put up a list that says GRU are these groups and they have carried out these activities, and we conclude that this is what they've been doing, and saying so very explicitly. And I mean, things like the black energy attacks in Ukraine, a VPN filter that we've talked about. I mean, these are things that we've seen attributed, but it is kind of different seeing this stuff, straight up there on gov.uk.
It is. And, the United States and the Dutch are in on this as well. The US DOJ has charged 7 intelligence officers. And I believe this relates to the anti-doping hack around the time of the Winter Olympics. Also, attempts to own up the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Of course, that relating to the whole Skripal thing.
Yes, and the I think we talked two or three weeks ago when the Dutch had first kind of started announcing that they captured a bunch of, you know, Russian close access hackers. And I think we made some jokes at the time about them having hacker equipment that the Dutch had seen.
Well, anyway, they got their laptop, man, and they found a whole bunch of evidence on it, which means they probably got the slap the cuffs on, like, with the thing unlocked, right?
Yeah, no, that I mean, that bit of the, you know, seeing that detail play out is a great example of, you know, actually having some, you know, some things that we can look at. But yeah,
he got Ulbricht.
Yeah, no, it was funny seeing you know, the pictures of the wireless gear and the car and the antennas and the, you know, cell uplink for hacking people's wireless networks. But yeah, like the fact that they got the laptop Ulbricht style and a bunch of phones, and one of the phones had, like, you know, a taxi receipt for like an Uber ride.
Oh, this was hilarious, wasn't it? It was like GRU headquarters to the airport or something.
Yeah, something like that. which is, you know, and of course, you know, a bunch of other information about other places that they'd been hacking. So yeah, just like super embarrassing for the Russians, one would imagine. And, you know, a bit of a coup for the Dutch, I think. So good to see some more details on that. But yeah, the whole kind of arc of seeing this stuff exposed in such clarity, you know, is a real change of pace, I think. And, you know, the details of the attacks on the anti-doping agencies and seeing some details about attacks into, you know, U.S. nuclear energy company Westinghouse, like, you know, this is, you know, them trying to shine a light, you know, on the cockroaches scuttling around rather than letting them hide.
Damn, man. Strong words from you. Now, we got this great alert here from US CERT. You know, and this is stuff that I guess we've long suspected was the case, but it's interesting seeing, you know, DHS come out and actually say it, which is that APT crews are actively exploiting managed service providers at the moment. And I'm going to just go take a wild guess and say that MSSPs have got to be a part of that target group.
Of course, yeah. I mean, the you know, it's a beautiful place for supply chain attacks and the managed service providers and security ones, especially because of the elevated level of access and that kind of thing. Yeah, this is, you know, I think one of the more important things we've seen come out of US CERT recently, just because, you know, those managed service providers are in such a privileged position everywhere. They are such big and obvious targets. And frankly, they're easy targets. I mean, you know, I've done a lot of pen testing over the years. We've broken into a lot of MSPs and that kind of thing. It's, you know, these people don't take it as seriously as they must. And having this on paper from the US CERT, from DHS, you know, is a helpful tool for customers to beat their managed service providers up with and say, what are you doing? Why should we trust you when we are being told that you're getting owned?
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, a lot, I think, is what you're looking for. Now, this story is kind of funny, right? Google has shut down Google Plus. Didn't even know it was still around, to be honest. I think that was the surprising part of the headline. but it turns out, you know, they basically took a look at their API and realized that it was a dumpster fire that was exposing, like, and I'm going to use that word carefully, but could have exposed, you know, details of over 500,000 users. So they basically nuked the whole platform. You know, and of course, you know, when Google launched Google Plus, it was going to take on Facebook. It was this huge thing. And then they tried almost turning it into a blogging platform. It was kind of trying to be what Medium eventually became. And now it's dead and no one's going to miss it. The end.
No, I don't think so. And the I mean, the interesting bit of this story perhaps is that Google appears to have identified the particular feature that was being, or the particular feature that could be abused in Google Plus, which was, you know, an API that third-party apps could use to retrieve profile information, and they identified that during the internal audit work for GDPR, which, I mean, something good came out of GDPR. So that's
nice. that's awesome. I'm guessing also, you know, there's a few people taking a look at their APIs after the whole Cambridge Analytica thing too.
Well, exactly that too. And I mean, I think the level of data that they're talking about here is kind of much less than, you know, we were talking about in the Facebook case. And of course, it's, you know, made less bad by the fact that there were no users of interest on Google Plus and no data worth nicking. The thing that I maybe laugh the most about this particular story, other than that they just put a bullet in the head of Google Plus, is that they had some stats that said 90% of all Google Plus sessions don't last more than 5 seconds.
Wow. That's like wrong way, go back, pretty much, isn't it? That's pretty much a misclick at that point. Now, look, staying with Google, they've actually enabled G Suite alerts for, you know, for government-backed hacking attempts against G Suite accounts. They're now mandatory, which, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is a useful feature, I guess. I mean, it's good that Google have this and that they're sufficiently confident in it that they're willing to push it out to everybody, you know, other than the few people who kind of turned it on themselves. The question I do have is, saying you get one of these notifications, what exactly are you supposed to do about it?
Yeah, it's sort of like someone saying a very highly skilled assassin is plotting to kill you. Just thought we'd let you know. You know? Yeah. Like, what do you do apart from not use computers?
Yeah, well, exactly, right? I mean, enjoy the last remaining bits of your life. I don't know.
But look, I'm guessing, you know, people might then do a bit of reading or maybe use a UTF token or U2F token or whatever, you know. I mean, it's not a bad thing, let's put it that way. And funnily enough, you know, that Twitter account, Sandbox Escaper, this is the girl who always, like, when she has a bad day, tends to drop O-Day on Twitter. And they tweeted just this morning that, why did Gmail just throw a notification that government attackers are trying to get into my account? Not even kidding. Maybe it's because you're always dropping O-Day on Twitter. I'm gonna say that's maybe a reason.
Yeah, I think it's because government attackers are trying to get into your account. So yeah, my condolences and OPSEC++.
Yeah, enjoy. Enjoy getting grucked. Basically is what I'm going to say there. Now, of course, yeah, Google, another Google story here. They've actually changed the rules for third-party apps and like how much data they can access. And this comes after reports. I'm not even sure that we covered them, but there were reports that like developers that were authorized, linked to people's Gmail accounts were like, you know, developers were just like reading their email and stuff to sort of tune ML sets, and it was all a bit creepy. So they're changing some rules here.
Yeah, no, this is good to see. And there's almost nothing that you want to have full access to your inbox. And I can't imagine what sort of person wants to install a Google add-on that has access to your inbox. This sounds like a bad idea. But yes, at least breaking it up so that things that need to send mail don't immediately get read access, and a bunch of other controls around getting security reviews of software that's going to have access to people's mailboxes. Like, that's a good step. Good on Google for doing it.
Now, Catalin Kimpanu at ZDNet wrote this story, and I'm a little bit miffed because I kind of had this paper in my back pocket and I was going to maybe do a feature on it. But well spotted, Catalin. But yeah, some people wrote up a really interesting research paper about all of this TLS interception enterprise gear. You know, this is the stuff that you put on your network and install certificates on all of your desktops, and then you're proxying, you know, all of this SSL traffic. And of course, that's used for content inspection and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, these researchers like just shredded it, and they found some really like damning stuff, like how some of these border devices, when they then go out and connect to to a website via SSL, sometimes they're not even doing proper certificate validation. Like, they will swallow self-signed certs and stuff. So, I mean, you know, we've often talked about theoretical risks involved with deploying this type of equipment. This paper really demonstrates how real those risks are.
Yeah, like, because I read the first couple of lines of the story about this research from Concordia University in Montreal, I thought, this is going to be a boring snooze fest about how they don't have all the perfect cipher settings and boring. And I skimmed down and I skimmed past the list of things they tested. I thought, okay, yeah, that's a good selection, I guess. And then I skimmed down to the things that they had tested, and then it was like, oh. Yeah, actually, this is proper good research, and it really is as bad as you imagined. And they've covered some really fun edge cases, like some of these devices will accept their own certificate when validating third-party sites. So you nick the proof key off your like McAfee box or whatever, and then use that to generate certs for other things, and then it will accept that, which is, I mean, obviously just completely stupid.
McAfee says that it generates a public-private key pair when you install this thing, but actually it ships with a pre-generated key pair. So, like, there's all this sort of stuff, and I think Komodo and Endian, they don't do certificate validation in default setups because a checkbox for accepting all certificates is checked by default in its configuration. WebTitan, UserGate, and Komodo do not perform any certificate validation. I mean, it is terrible. WebTitan, really, Microsoft, is. UserGate, Cisco, and Komodo still accept MD4.
No, surely MD5, surely.
Nope, MD4. I mean, it's that bad, right? What? So that's one to have a read of.
Yeah, and that's super grim. If you've got TLS intercept in your network, you should really read this because it's so bad.
But look, I mean, bless. You know, we are moving towards a TLS intercept world, right? Like, people want content inspection, and given clients are the weakest link, it makes a lot of sense. But God, can we just have some good equipment, please?
Apparently not. That's not a thing we're allowed in this industry.
Now, a while ago, of course, we spoke about Phantom Secure. This is the company that was doing custom BlackBerry phones that they were selling to organized crime. You know, they got rolled up by the FBI pretty hard, and now the chief executive has pleaded guilty to a raft of offenses.
Yeah, apparently the Mounties are working with the FBI and the Australian authorities. They went undercover and actually got the guy saying, yes, we absolutely made this specifically for drug trafficking. So, yeah, not surprising that he pled guilty for facilitating the distribution of cocaine, heroin and methamphetamine all around the world. And, yes, is forfeiting something like $80 million worth of money and a bunch, you know, tens of millions of other assets, including cryptocurrency. So I'm sure that will go up in value once it's forfeited to the government and they can make a profit.
Sucks to be him. Now, we've got a great blog post here from Project Zero.
Yes, Project Zero has been working on fuzzing the WebKit rendering engine used by Safari and actually Chrome in some cases, Chrome on iOS notably. They did a bunch of fuzzing against the WebKit engine a year ago. They reported a bunch of bugs to Apple, and they thought it would be fun a year later to come back and rerun the same fuzzing process against modern WebKit and see, you know, kind of what the bugs that fell out looked like. And so this is quite a good write-up of that process. The short version is they found, I think, 17 bugs last time they fuzzed it a year ago. They found 7 this time, and all of which, I think, other than maybe one, were kind of new bugs introduced into the codebase in the last year. And it does kind of suggest that, you know, Apple's still got a few things to learn about in terms of developing secure software reliably, but also testing their own software. I mean, the fact that Google's, you know, had a fuzzer that they made public a year ago that could find these bugs does make you wonder, you know, how much work Apple is doing, whether they're doing quite enough work to test their own code prior to releasing it.
Indeed. Microsoft has pushed a patch for a zero day that is apparently being exploited in the wild by a group, an APT group called Fruityama.
Yeah, I'm not even sure who Fruityama is. I'm going to assume, you know, statistically it's the GRU. That seems to be what's going on lately. but this was a local Prevesque on Windows. But the same crew had been using a couple of other Windows Zero Day as well in the last, last couple of years. I'm interested to see who they are. I don't know yet.
Well, there you go. And Adam, to cap it off this week, we've got a reading list item for the listeners.
Yes, the U.S. Government Accountability Office has published a report called Weapons Systems Cybersecurity and subtitled DoD Just Beginning to Grapple with the Scale of Vulnerabilities. And it's quite a long write-up of a bunch of work done investigating the cybersecurity of weapons systems in the U.S. military. It's, you know, 50 pages of fairly dense reading, but there's some real gems in there, you know, talking about the process of doing adversarial security testing against weapons systems. One bit that amused me in particular was a report that some pen testers who were doing work there popped up a dialogue box on a weapon system console saying, please insert 2 quarters to continue. So that seems pretty fun.
And damn. Definitely,
that would not be ideal when you're sitting on your, you know, on your boat in the middle of a shooting war and you have to stick some money in.
Who's got a quarter? Who's got a quarter? Quickly.
But yeah, definitely worth a read. You know, obviously the intersection between, you know,
internet weapons
and actual weapons is a thing that listeners of this podcast are probably into. So yeah, have a read on your lunch break, perhaps.
All right. Well, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Insomnia security consultant and 90s teen icon Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Andrew Wilson, the chief executive of Senatas. Senatas is an Australian company listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. They are best known for making Layer 2 hardware encryption devices. They're very popular in defense networks and high security environments. And Andrew is joining us today to express a bit of unease about Australia's proposed Access and Assistance Bill. This is the legislation that would force technology makers to help Australian authorities access encrypted content when they have a warrant. He thinks it's possible that, even though it's not the intent of the bill, it's possible that some countries that Senatas exports to could be uncomfortable with this legislation. Chiefly, he says, he's worried that other countries could look at the bill and worry that it could force companies like Senatas to backdoor their products. He wants to see an export carve-out for defense export licensed products. That's the bulk of the interview, but before we spoke about that, we spoke about supply chains. With everything in the news at the moment, I thought it would be a good idea to ask Andrew how Senatas eliminates supply chain risk for their equipment or, you know, supply chain concerns. Here's what he said.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Well, firstly, we contract our manufacturing to an Australian company that's located in just at the back of Monash University in Clayton. So there's trustworthiness in that entity because it's an Australian entity. Secondly, there's a whole bunch of components that we can only source through certain suppliers, mainly out of the US for those sensitive components. And that is all that supply chain, and those components are audited as part of our certification processes that we undertake in the EU, the UK, and the US and Australia.
So that's a is that a FIPS thing?
It's a FIPS thing. It's also a focus of one of the new security certifications that we're undertaking in France, which is a common criteria EAL 4 plus certification. They have a different take on it compared with the take that Australia has on that common criteria certification. So they are looking at, you know, where we're sourcing components from.
So, no, that's interesting. It's interesting because, yeah. You know, I mean, this supply chain hardware stuff, I mean, it's all in the news at the moment, whether that's whether it's real or false. I mean, who knows? But yeah. Certainly supply chain risk when it comes to something like as sensitive as an encryptor, right? It makes sense to address it. But, I mean, as someone who's familiar with the experience of dealing with this, can you imagine trying to get the same level of supply chain assurance at scale? Because I understand that, like, for a company such as Senatas, you're making, you know, specialized hardware at sort of medium volume. Can you even imagine trying to apply the same sort of rigor at enterprise scale?
I think it'd be impossible, you know, with China manufacturing many of these components at scale. You know, how you can get that supply chain assurance when you have to procure those components from foreign countries, a difficult question to answer. It's not the first time there have been questions about dodgy components coming from, you know, manufacturers and suppliers offshore. I don't think that's the first time that this question has been raised.
No, it's not. But it's the first time that it's been published in a way with all these specifics that have turned out to be wrong. Anyway, we are talking about something else today. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, right? Because I just thought, Australian manufacturer, sensitive equipment, what do you do? And, you know, you've answered that, so thank you. But look, the reason we're talking today is, a few weeks ago I was in Melbourne, you and I and Julian Fay and Simon Galbally, all of Senatas, we went out and we had lunch. And something interesting came up in conversation. The Australian government is looking to pass its, you know, assistance and access bill, which is the so-called, you know, anti-encryption legislation designed to assist law enforcement in accessing end-to-end encrypted messages from devices. And you said something very interesting to me, which is that you were concerned that there could be a perception in some of the markets that you export your equipment to that somehow they will fear supply chain risk from Australian manufactured equipment. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. Look, you know, I have some sympathy for law enforcement agencies in Australia trying to protect Australian citizens from terrorists and criminals and various nasty organisations trying to take advantage of our country. And this sort of bill obviously has been drafted to address some of the weaknesses in our law enforcement capabilities because criminals are using, you know, sophisticated encryption techniques. But what hasn't been considered, I don't think, in enough detail is with this bill, as it's currently drafted, the impact on Australian cybersecurity industries and manufacturers and developers of Australian cybersecurity products, and we are one of those companies, and it's about perception and trust. So, yes, we're concerned as the bill is currently drafted that it may damage the perception and the trust in Australian products in certain markets. And I'm not talking about the Five Eyes markets. I'm talking about many other markets that we export to, in that the bill as it's currently drafted may give the power to the government to introduce systematic weaknesses in Australian products and therefore the perception that our products can't be trusted.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because the bill explicitly says that it can't be used to introduce weaknesses, systemic weaknesses into, you know, systems of communication and whatever. But, you know, I've been speaking to some other people around Canberra about this. And one of the problems is that, you know, deciding what's reasonable and proportionate according to the bill and deciding what is and is not a systemic weakness, that is, as far as I understand, that's solely at the discretion. That call is to be made by the Attorney General, not a court, which is a little bit alarming.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bill has is broad enough to, if the government does think it is necessary to compel a company like ours to introduce something into the product, I think there's enough in that bill to cause other countries to ask the question about whether Australian-based products can be trusted.
That's the thing. It's a perception. Yeah, exactly, right? So it's not even about whether or not this is actually a risk in the bill. It's that it's a perceived risk. And I will say, too, that, I mean, you know, I've been dealing with Senatas for a long time. And after the Snowden disclosures, I mean, they put a rocket under your business because people wanted to buy all of a sudden technology that wasn't necessarily American. And again, we're talking about countries outside of the Five Eyes Alliance there.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly... you know, we've had some success as a result of that because Australia is considered a trustworthy country and the supply of products like ours can be trusted, or more trusted, than products developed in some other Five Eyes countries, for example. So we've done quite well in Asia and the Middle East, etc. But I think this bill threatens to wind that back for us and could be damaging to us and might eventually compel us to manufacture, you know, offshore, which would be costly, expensive, and would be, I think, you know, a drain on Australia's intellectual capability and intellectual property, ultimately, if we have to leave.
Well, I mean, this is a difficult conversation for you, of course, because the Australian government is one of your major customers.
Yeah, it is, certainly, absolutely. But, you know, we have an example at our feet, and a recent example in Australia, actually, of exactly what this perception, what impact this perception issue can have on an organisation. If you remember, Huawei was banned from participating in the NBN and 5G infrastructures because there was the perception that Huawei technology might be compromised because it has, is potentially, could be compelled by the Chinese government to introduce some systematic weaknesses into that product.
Well, I suspect there's some corroborating intelligence on that one, but I still take your point because I have heard people in government and people in various agencies express, you know, they've expressed to me that the point is really that, you know, laws on China's books would allow them to compel, and that makes them, you know, makes them nervous. So I guess you're saying the same thing could happen here.
That's exactly right, and it's been very damaging to Huawei's revenue in Australia and business interests. So, you know, likewise, if we're exporting and there is the same question mark over Australian technology and the government's power to interfere with such products, it is probable that our revenues and business will be impacted in overseas markets.
Okay, so I'm guessing what you would like to see is maybe some sort of exporters carve-out built into this legislation that says that, you know, this legislation does not apply to any equipment that leaves Australia. I mean, is that the sort of thing that you'd be looking for?
Well, certainly that is one aspect of it, but also we'd be looking for an exemption for products that are certified by NIST, under the FIPS regime and common criteria here in Australia and in the EU. We would look for an exemption for those certified products that are exported from this bill. I think that would take care of the issue from our perspective. One other thing I think the government might consider if it amends this bill to protect Australian industry and exports is that it might exempt products being exported which has a valid export permit attached, which our product does, and many other cybersecurity products will have for export.
So this is like a defence export licence?
Correct. That's exactly right, which we're required which is required for us to export to any country.
And have you had any discussions with government? I mean, I know that you've got connections with the Australian government. Have you spoken to anyone about this? Has it fallen on deaf ears? Are they receptive?
I think they're being receptive. I think they've acknowledged that this issue hasn't been considered in enough detail. And given the length of time of consultation before the bill was actually put to Parliament or put to the PJCIS, you can understand why they might not have considered this in enough detail. So we've raised.
Well, I mean, the consultation was a joke. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, it was extremely short. I understand there were 14,000 submissions. There was a 10-day consultation period. or a consideration period before it was put to the PJCIS. And I can't imagine anybody getting through 14,000 submissions in that period of time.
No. I mean, that's just, yeah. That's right. So you've heard some positive feedback then. Are you confident that this is something that will be addressed?
No, I'm not confident. I'm not confident that this is something that will be addressed unless the consultation period and the consideration period is extended so that these things can be considered in a reasonable time frame. But certainly we continue to push it with our contacts, and they do acknowledge that there might be an impact on Australian industry, which is a concern for them.
Yes.
But the objective of this bill is not to impact Australian industry and exporters of high assurance security products.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that there is some sort of carve out introduced into the legislation and that it's not too late to fix it. Andrew Wilson, thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate that.
That was Andrew Wilson there, Chief Executive of Senatas and my recent lunch companion. Big thanks to Senatas for sponsoring this week's show and also for the tasty, tasty medium rare Wagyu eye fillet that they bought me the other week in Melbourne. It was delicious. A great meal in great company. Thanks again to Senatas, and you can find them at senatas.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.